is our guest speaker this morning is the curator of the DeGolyer Library in the History of Science and Technology at the University of Oklahoma. He is a man who has done considerable work in the field not only of science itself, but also in the field of the history of science. He has his master's degree from Purdue University in physics and his PhD from Harvard in the field of the history of science. He is going to talk to us this morning and is going to present an illustrated lecture. This afternoon he will be in the student lounge from 3:30 until 4:30 to speak informally and to discuss various topics of interest with the students who are there. So we would invite you to come down to the student lounge this afternoon at 3:30. Dr. Roller's topic this morning is science and beauty, and we shall now hear from him.
Thank you very much, Mr. Klotz. The history of science is a new and very rapidly expanding intellectual and academic field. To be sure, science has always had a past, and scientists have always been interested in at least the recent past of science. This, I think, is inevitable because present scientific work builds on past knowledge. But it's only in the last few decades that serious historical study of the past of science has begun. And this morning I would like to discuss, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say ramble through, some developments in the history of science that I find particularly intriguing. To begin with, I would like to indicate just what I am going to mean by the terms science and scientist. These are rather ticklish words to use, because in 20th century America, science and scientific have become catchwords. They're used by Madison Avenue to sell floor wax and cigarettes, and they appear in a very wide variety of usages, scientific football and library science and things of this kind. Engineers think of themselves as being scientists, and medical science proves, we're told, that cancer won't kill you any faster than any other cigarettes and so on. The American Medical Association, in its frantic propaganda attempts at, I don't quite know what, certainly not healing the sick, has claimed that physicians have to be free from government interference because they are scientists. And everyone knows that scientists have to have freedom. Now, these various usages give us a very blurred image of what science is. And when I use the term science in what I'm going to be saying, I'm going to mean an activity engaged in by scientists. And that activity is the attempt to explain the world of nature. The explanations that the scientists seek for and find are what we call scientific knowledge. They are what fill the encyclopedias and textbooks. Scientific knowledge is always changing, but it turns out that science itself, the search for knowledge, does not change. And when we define science in this way, we are talking about what men like Newton, Lavoisier, Darwin, Galileo, Dalton, Mendel, and Einstein do. And what they do is attempt to explain natural phenomena. Now, this definition enables us to eliminate a great deal of what normally passes for science, Madison Avenue to begin with. But is a surgeon a scientist? No, he's a skilled craftsman engaged in saving lives, not in attempting to explain nature. Is an engineer who builds a great dam a scientist? No, he's a technologist, making water available to thirsty thousands and saving the lives of many people. You see, the surgeon and the engineer don't have to claim to be scientists to be of any good. Indeed, their improvement of the control that we have over nature is far more important to you and to me than is the work of scientists. For science is a useless activity in itself, in terms of providing for the basic physical necessities of life. To be sure, in relatively recent times, some technologists have applied some scientific knowledge in many useful ways. But this is a phenomenon of perhaps the last 200 years, at the very most. Before 1800, scientific knowledge had no useful applications. And science itself, the act of searching for that knowledge, has never been a useful activity, in the usual sense of the term, at least. Even today, to the degree that technologists use scientific knowledge, this is a part of technology, this activity of theirs, and not a scientific one. Now, in the early days of man's life on Earth, science, the attempt to explain nature, was not in any sense a crucial activity comparable to the task of obtaining food, clothing, and shelter. Only a culture that has taken care of those raw fundamental needs can afford to support parasites that live off the producers without themselves contributing to the necessities of life. Parasites such as scientists and kings and priests and soldiers and poets and teachers and students. Now, some of these parasites who make no direct contribution to the production of food, clothing, and shelter nevertheless contribute to the fulfillment of important secondary needs. Needs that are only secondary to the fundamental ones. Kings provide government and soldiers provide protection. And these needs come into prominence once settled communities and complex urban civilizations begin to develop. One might even say that such functions as government and protection are an essential part of the food, clothing, shelter complex, at least for an urban civilization. And once you get specialization of effort in production, then you need some sort of an educational system to pass on to the next generation knowledge of these specialized skills. When a culture has taken care of its physical needs, a new kind of need appears. Perhaps it has been there all along, but it can only be met by a civilization that has sufficient surplus in the economy to support a different class of parasites who are engaged in activities quite unrelated to physical needs. And this new need might be called spiritual needs, summed up so aptly in that phrase, man cannot live by bread alone. The priest, the poet, the musician, the painter, professions such as these are concerned with meeting man's longing for something beyond the physical. A little reflection will show, perhaps surprisingly, that although technology is concerned with providing for our physical needs, that science, the attempt to understand and explain nature, is best classified as an attempt at fulfilling spiritual needs. When we look over the whole wide world, we find that urban civilizations, taking care of physical needs, are in existence at least 9,000 years ago. They begin to develop specialization of tasks, organization of society with government and armies, and no later than 6,000 years ago, they begin to be concerned with spiritual in the broad sense that I've been using the term. The earliest such cultures crop up in the center of this map, at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, in that traditional cradle of civilization that Breasted called the Fertile Crescent. We have particularly impressive archaeological remains from Mesopotamia, where there was a succession of mighty civilizations, Sumer, Babylon, Assyria. Here, writing was invented, and today we have fragmentary written documents, some 5,000 or 6,000 years old, and large quantities of documents from about 1600 BC on in the form of tablets such as these. On these tablets from these Mesopotamian civilizations, we find algebra, long thought to be a much later development. We find elaborate educational systems in these cultures, the development of the legal code of Hammurabi, the preparation of maps. We also find an epic literature, represented by the Epic of Gilgamesh, in which the story of the flood appears. The next slide is a picture of a 7th century BC version of part of the Epic of Gilgamesh. It happens to be the particular tablet that contains the account of the flood. Now, in this same general period that Mesopotamia has developed writing and all of these elaborate side affairs, the Egyptian civilization was producing breathtaking achievements. In the Nile Valley, as well as in Mesopotamia, we find writing, and indeed there's even some dispute over which came first, Mesopotamian or Egyptian. The ancient Egyptians performed incredible architectural feats, of course. They developed elaborate techniques of computation, as shown on some of the old papyri. They performed delicate surgical operations, and they left behind a wealth of artistic beauty. In the Aegean, the Minoan civilization rose to prominence at just about the same time, 1600 BC, in the island of Crete at the south in this map. And the remains of this once mighty culture are of enormous beauty and include fabulous palaces furnished with beautiful frescoes. This is the king's room in the Palace of Knossos. Grand staircase. We have the next one, please. This is the queen's room with its frescoes. And off to the left is a bathroom with a bathtub in it. with water piped in 3,000 years before any European queen could boast of such luxury. Now, simultaneously, on the Greek mainland, the Mycenaean culture was coming to prominence. This is, in the foreground, Mycenae, home of Agamemnon. And in the next slide, we have the Lion Gate, from which his chariots drove on their way to the Trojan Wars. Lioness Gate, it really ought to be called. These Greek civilizations also had writing, which they probably got from Crete, and from Mesopotamia. They also turned out a variety of items of different kinds. Beautiful golden death masks, all sorts of personal ornaments, gold ornaments shown here, personal ornaments, jewelry, beautiful golden utensils, like this cup from Baptio, and all sorts of things, even some exceedingly prosaic things like these. Now, you see, in all of these cultures, we find that the lush economic situation is making it possible to give attention to man's spiritual needs, in this broad sense of the term, as well as to his physical wants. We've already seen some examples of painting from Egypt, and these delicate frescoes from Crete. And early literary achievements ran from the epic literature of Mesopotamia to the Aegean epics of Homer. From the city of Ur in Mesopotamia, the king's royal standard has survived, a beautiful mosaic that gives us some insight into daily royal life. And from Ur, we even have a complete game, although no one knows how to play it today. Clearly, at least among the upper classes, there was plenty of leisure time for activities of all sorts. And preeminent, as always, in the task of seeking solutions to man's spiritual needs, there was a priesthood found in all of these civilizations. And yet, in none of them do we find anything that might be called science. Technology, the attempt to control nature, yes. But these ancient men lived in a natural world that they did not want to comprehend. They had all of the prerequisites for science except one. No one had yet created the idea of attempting to explain the natural world. Expressed otherwise, the desire to engage in science is not an inherent characteristic of mankind. Given all of the prerequisites, including that most precious one of all, leisure time, men's minds do not turn to the attempt to explain nature on at least any large scale. Science first appears in classical Greek antiquity as a part of philosophy. It begins among the Ionian Greeks on the eastern shore of the Aegean, and within two or three centuries has reached full maturity in Athens. Now, the origins of the glory that was Greece has left its students in despair, throwing up their hands and saying it was simply a miracle, the Greek miracle. This is Athens, specifically the Agora, or marketplace, now being cleared by American archaeologists. This is another view with the Acropolis of Athens in the background, for Athens, like most Greek cities, grew up around two such centers, the Agora and a hill or Acropolis that could be fortified and defended in times of stress. In the Golden Age of Greece, the 4th century BC, a succession of notable leaders, and chief among them Pericles, chose to decorate this city as none has been decorated before. On the west side of the Acropolis is the Propylaea, the entrance structure to the hill. At the extreme right, the little temple of the wingless Nike, one of the most perfect temples ever built. And as one goes up through the Propylaea, the entrance, and comes out on top of the Acropolis, one encounters Pericles' most famous achievement. Pericles collected money from Athens' allies for defense, and then shamelessly diverted the funds to something more important than defense, beauty, and built the most beautiful building here that the world has ever seen. Every column different, and this most geometric of structures does not contain a single straight line. The sculptures that decorated it, shown here, are now in the British Museum, part of the Elgin marbles there. It's one of the friezes, and this is the pediment, the east pediment. From the Parthenon, one looks out on its companion building, the Porch of the Maidens. And if one looks out through the entrance, the Propylaea, to the west, there is another hill, the Pinx. And here on this distant hill, the Pinx, the citizens of Athens met and voted in this now deserted field, implementing that basic principle of democracy, one man, one vote. And just as the Parthenon was supported, the roof of the Parthenon, on 46 columns, each one of them somewhat different from the rest, so this most perfect of democracies rested squarely on the shoulders of all the citizens. Here was pure democracy, not representative government. hear from this platform on this hill such orators as Themistocles and Pericles harangued the citizens, and the citizens decided. And if they decided for war, they had made a decision to send themselves to war and not somebody else. And every man, so to speak, went home and got his weapons and joined the army. A perfect democracy, too fragile to last for long. Looking back toward the Acropolis from the Pinks, one sees an intervening hill, the Areopagus, where the Supreme Court of Greece met, and incidentally, St. Paul preached later from this hilltop. On the sunny side of the Acropolis lies the Theater of Dionysus. Here both the drama and music as we know it were invented. And as every citizen voted and fought in the army, so every citizen went to the dramatic productions here in the first of theaters. The Romans distorted this, as they did most things they touched. This should be a circular orchestra. They changed it to a semicircular one. They didn't find one Greek theater. The theater at Epidaurus, which still exists, is still used, or is used again, and shows us what a Greek theater ought to look like. In the next slide, one sees the orchestra at Epidaurus. Now, on the other side of the Acropolis, from the Theater of Dionysus, lies the Agora. The American School of Classical Studies has rebuilt this building, the Stoa of Attalus II of Pergamum, to show the sorts of buildings that once surrounded the Agora. Just as Pericles chose to decorate the Acropolis with plastic beauty, so he chose to decorate this once populous Agora with intellectual beauty. Pericles made Athens a magnet for the finest intellects and the leading teachers of the world, and he created the intellectual climate that produced Socrates. In the Agora, Socrates walked and taught, and here philosophy was invented. Here, too, geometry reached fruition. And many people consider Athens in the Periclean Age to have been the peak of the human race and would argue that we've been going downhill ever since. Here were invented democracy, philosophy, courts of law, the drama, music, geometry. Now, Socrates taught Plato, and Plato taught Aristotle. And it's in the hands of these last two men that science, as we know it, becomes fully defined. From its beginnings in Ionian Greece, science was completely established in its modern form in a span of only 300 years by the Greek culture. Here, and only here, science was invented. The Greek idea that nature is susceptible to study and explanation is to a large degree based upon the assumption that there is a unity in natural phenomena. One of the important Ionian scientific theories is called monism, the view that everything in the universe is made of one single primary substance. It has been suggested that while other cultures were seeking for spiritual satisfaction through the creation and elaboration of the concept of monotheism, that the Greeks turned to monism. And from this point of view, one might, I think, reasonably regard monism and monotheism as different aspects of the same yearning for unity and for comprehension, the same desire to fulfill spiritual needs. Now, it is very tempting to associate the invention of science for the Greeks with the Greek miracle in general, to suggest that somehow the beauty of music and of the Parthenon and of drama and geometry has something to do with the blossoming of science in Athens. To be sure, beauty in the plastic arts had existed before Athens, but the Athenian conception of beauty seems to have had a tremendous breadth, encompassing both intellectual and artistic beauty together. Science was invented only once. There had not been science earlier, and every civilization that has had science since classical Greece has inherited it from the Greeks. As the unique Greek supremacy in science waned, it was picked up by the Islamic civilization, which incidentally was intensely monotheistic, for whatever that's worth. We know very little about the history of Islamic science, although it is perhaps intriguing that one of the Muslim scientists best known in the West is the Persian physicist Omar Khayyam, who is also one of the best known of Oriental poets. The peak period of Islamic achievement in science was also an era of notable literary work in Arabic. Although Rome took almost everything that it possessed of note from the Greeks, the Romans were not interested in science. Science did not come into Western civilization until the 12th and 13th centuries, and then by the back door, so to speak, from Islam. Since that time, it has, of course, spread with the European world expansion to other parts of the world. Although the study of nature and the attempt to explain nature became a respectable Christian activity in the 13th century with Albert the Great and his pupil Thomas, the early centuries of European science were very largely devoted to assimilating the knowledge that had come from Islam. The Greek knowledge, with its Muslim additions, profoundly affected the Western culture in all fields, from theology to literary criticism, and produced the replacement of Augustinian Christianity by Thomism, as well as providing a basis for European science. The late 15th and early 16th centuries sees a bursting forth of that artistic revolution that we call the Renaissance. But they also see the beginnings of the Protestant Reformation and of European science as well. And it's very difficult to imagine that these three events are unrelated. Let's look at a few examples. Printing with movable type began in the second half of the 15th century. The woodblock, as an artistic medium, was invented at the same time, and by the early 16th century, engraving on wood had become a popular mode of expression for artists. Now, in the span of the 16th century, there occurred a very notable shift in attitudes in those sciences concerned with the classification of minerals, animals, and plants. Whereas in 1500, biological and geological classification included such characteristics as taste, odor, name, and usefulness of the various plants and minerals, by 1600, classification is almost totally in terms of visual characteristics. This is the great herbal, despite the Gothic type, a work in English, of 1523, and in this we find plants arranged alphabetically by name, with groupings concerned with the medical use of plants and their value as food. But by the end of the century, this is a page from the same work, by the end of the century, there has been a total shift to classifying plants in terms of leaf shape, flowers, and other purely visual characteristics. Now, it has long been customary to say that this change occurred because scientists began to observe, because scientists for the first time began to look at plants and draw pictures of what they actually saw. This argument is not borne out by the historical evidence. The first book to display the new emphasis on visual characteristics is the Herbarium Vivae Iconis of Otto Brunfels, a book that is filled with woodblocks engraved from accurate drawings of plants, drawings so precisely faithful to the subject that they show withered leaves where a withered leaf appeared in the particular plant being used as a model. But Otto Brunfels, author of this book, was incapable of making these drawings. He was a botanist. The drawings are not the work of a botanist at all. Rather, they are the work of a professional artist, and his name is Hans Weidetz. He was a follower of the famous Albrecht Dürer. The textual material in Brunfels' herbal is not in the least novel. It's something found in countless botanical books before him. Expressed otherwise, there is only one thing novel about the botany in Brunfels' book, and that is these pictures, these woodcuts. And Brunfels had nothing to do with them, despite the fact that he has been acclaimed as a great botanist because of these pictures. On the other hand, what the artist, Hans Weidetz, contributed was a very novel talent, the totally new technique of engraving on wood, or to be precise, drawing for engraving on wood. He was a thoroughly professional artist who prepared drawings for some 1,300 major woodblocks during his lifetime. And Weidetz is known today for the faithfulness of his portrayals. As one historian of art has put it, Weidetz could draw with precision anything he could see. On the other hand, Brunfels complains in print that he's being asked to describe plants of no medicinal value whatsoever. The artistic abilities of Hans Weidetz and of a host of other professional artists produced, in the mid-16th century, large numbers of identical copies of drawings of plants. By the end of that century, all European botanists had available large reference libraries of pictures of plants. Furthermore, they knew that identical collections of such pictures existed in libraries all over Europe. They were thus able to say, by such and such a plant, I mean that which is pictured on such and such a page of so-and-so's book. By the end of the century, botanical classification had shifted to the use of visual characteristics. But this shift was produced by Renaissance artists, not by botanists. In the study of human anatomy, there is a book that plays a role similar to that of Brunfels' herbal in botany. This is the work on the structure of the human body, the De Fabrica of Andreas Vesalius. Vesalius was a Belgian physician and anatomist who drifted to Italy, where he studied at the University of Padua and earned a living tutoring students. In 1543, he produced this book on anatomy. It has become famous, not for the textual material, but for the large and beautiful anatomical drawings it contains. K.
Countless historians of biology have written that modern anatomy began when Vesalius dissected cadavers and then drew just what he saw. This idea was elaborated in the late 19th and early 20th century into a beautiful, if unhistorical, story about how up to this time everyone had just sat around and read old Greek books, and since the Greeks didn't know anything about science, these readers didn't learn anything about science from those Greek books. Science, we are told, began when true scientists like Brunfels and Vesalius observed in the laboratory and drew what they saw. Now, we have already seen that Brunfels, the botanist, didn't draw what he saw. And a few years ago, an historian of art pointed out that Vesalius was a Belgian, but that these drawings are Italian. Furthermore, he said, they are perhaps by Titian, and are certainly from the Titian school of drawing. Hence, they could not possibly be the work of Vesalius, the Belgian physician and anatomist. Once given this clue, it was relatively easy to find out that Vesalius had a great deal of contact with a pupil of Titian's named Jan Stefan van Kalkar. And once this new view opened up, it also became apparent that no anatomist had ever seen on the dissecting table anything that looked like this. For these are not lifeless cadavers in this book, lying on a table, but they're living cadavers, if I may use the term, walking around. They're not cadavers prepared by a dissector and then hung up for a drawer to copy. A faithful photographic copy of a cadaver hanging up looks like a cadaver hanging up. This does not. The muscles of these men are flexed in use, in the attitudes of muscles in use for walking, for holding up an arm, and so on. As Plato would have put it, one doesn't see this with the eye of the forehead, but with the eye of the mind, with the eye of an artist's mind. And dissectors don't see such things. It's artists who view the world in this way. So the crucial contribution to Vesalius' book, the contribution that is said to have produced the beginning of modern anatomy by close attention to the detailed appearance of the human body, is again a contribution by Renaissance art and not by anatomists. One more example. Geology is often said to have begun with the De Re Metallica of George Agricola. Published within 25 years of the Brunfels and Vesalius books, you might imagine what it is famous for. Agricola's book is famous for its woodblocks. Woodblocks largely concerned with mining, but also with various aspects of mineralogy. Agricola, author of this book, could not possibly have made these drawings. They are the work of some Renaissance artist. I haven't found out who as yet. I am not going to pursue this subject further, but there are many other examples that confirm that a major shift in the nature of biology and geology did indeed occur in the mid-16th century, and that it was produced by artists and not by scientists. The scientists just followed along. The artists were not responsible for having these illustrations included in the books, and in some cases they actively opposed having their material ruined by having these pictures added to it. Let me turn now to another kind of interaction between what I like to call, at any rate, beauty and science. Probably the only city that has ever matched Pericles and Athens in beauty is Renaissance Florence. From the 14th century on, the Medici family led the rich bourgeoisie of Florence in the patronizing of the arts, and the great Renaissance artists crammed Florence with works of exquisite beauty, with churches, the great city hall, with its statuary in front of it, Michelangelo's David, although a copy, the baptistry of the cathedral, the ceiling, with its beautiful golden doors, Ghiberti, the doors of paradise, as Michelangelo called them, Donatello's, Mary Magdalene. It's probably the only city in the world where bridges are designed with an eye as to what they will look like together with their reflection in the River Arno after they have been built. But the Medicis, like Pericles, chose to decorate Florence with intellectual beauty as well as with beauty in the plastic arts. They brought in Greeks to teach Greek to Italians. They imported Greek manuscripts. They revived or at least aped Plato's Academy. And by the 16th and 17th centuries, Florence had produced a notable concentration of distinguished scientists. In Florence, surrounded by the beauty of the Italian Renaissance, lived and worked one of the most famous of scientists, Galileo Galilei. In the late 19th century, a legend grew up that Galileo was an experimenter who rolled balls down inclined planes and did various things at the University of Pisa, like throwing rocks and cannonballs off of the bell tower at his professors. We know today that these stories are not true, that he did not discover these things. However, we also know that he was a very notable scientist. His importance, however, was in the realm we would call today theoretical physics, and not mathematical physics, and not experimentation. Galileo insisted that to understand nature, one must construct a mathematical theory of nature. According to Galileo, one cannot learn about nature by rolling balls along sloping boards. Rather, one must roll spheres along planes. And that can only be done in the mind, of course. Galileo saw clearly that science was an intellectual activity and not a manual one. The Marxists have, in my opinion, made an unfortunate decision in deciding that science is closely allied to the manual arts. It's an understandable mistake in the Marxist philosophy that is so thoroughly devoted to emphasizing the importance of the working class. And one can understand how a Marxist philosopher can be intrigued by the idea that scientific discoveries are made in laboratories by processes related to bricklaying and ditch digging. But Galileo knew better. He knew that science was carried on not in the laboratory, but in the minds of men. He knew that science was a creative intellectual activity aimed at seeking a perfect pattern, far more perfect than anything that's found in nature, a pattern of truth that transcends nature. Being by training a mathematician, he had an understandable bias that mathematicians often have, namely that God is a mathematician who created the universe in a mathematical way. Therefore, said Galileo, the role of the scientist is to seek for the mathematical perfection and beauty that he who made the universe put into it. Now, where did he get these ideas? What made him seek for beauty and perfection and mathematics in imperfect nature? Let's take a quick look at his background. To begin with, he grew up in Tuscany, spending his early childhood in Pisa, the university city of Tuscany, and his youth in the Tuscan capital, Florence, the city of flowers. His father was a failure, at least from some points of view. Vincenzo Galileo was an unsuccessful merchant, and the family was in perpetual financial trouble. On the side, to be sure, he helped create opera. He taught his son, Galileo, the beauty of music. He taught him to perform on the lute. He taught him to appreciate painting, sculpture, poetry, and mathematics. Galileo's scientific achievements are so striking that it's very easy to forget that he engaged in notable literary criticism, devoting considerable time to a critical study of the writings of Italian poets, and he made a significant contribution to the contemporary dialogue on the relative merits of painting and sculpture as art forms. Now, one can, I think, be sympathetic to his father, Vincenzo Galilei. Here is a man who is an impoverished noble of Florence, reduced to trying to earn a living as a merchant. In Florence, which is noted both for its commercial and its artistic achievements, Vincenzo Galilei is so interested in music and mathematics and other forms of beauty that he's an utter failure financially. So he, in desperation, decided that the only hope for the future of the family is to get his son into some highly lucrative profession where he can make money hand over fist. Consequently, Galileo is sent to university to study to become a physician. It turns out, however, that his father has taught him too well. Galileo isn't interested in the physics that they teach at university. He isn't interested in any of the science they teach there. He wants to talk about beauty. His professors want to talk about facts. He wants to talk about mathematical perfection. They want to talk about the real world. And as everyone knows, when you take courses, you either play the teacher's game or you don't play. And Galileo, to put it delicately, left school. And yet he went on to become one of the most famous scientists of all times. Why? I don't mean for a moment to suggest that the way to become a great scientist or a great anything else is to flunk out of college. Galileo's failure at Pisa is just a symptom that he was out of step with the accepted knowledge of his day. But his greatness and his scientific achievements stem from his unswerving search for beauty, a bias that he got from his father and from his childhood environment in Florence. Let's look at another example, one in which the circumstances seem very different at first, but the results are much the same. Johann Kepler was a German contemporary of Galileo's. He was born half a century after Luther had posted his theses, And by Kepler's youth, the seemingly calm and neat world of medieval Western Christendom had blown apart into fragments that were themselves fragmenting. Two things stand out about Kepler's early life. First, his home was a madhouse. He had a bullying older brother, an epileptic sister, a mother who ended up being tried as a witch, and a father who finally gave up and ran away from home. Second, Kepler grew up in the midst of the Protestant Reformation, when the Catholic Counter-Reformation was getting into full swing. He was a devout Christian and firmly believed in the Christian ethic. Yet, although he had learned that Christianity had replaced the harsh Mosaic eye for an eye and with turn the other cheek, all around him he saw Christians trying to gouge out both eyes of other Christians. He was raised a Lutheran, and he learned at an early age that the best way to handle Catholics was to kill them all off. Committed by his environment to Protestantism as well as to Christianity, devout by nature and education, he sought escape from his hectic home life in the profession of theology. He went to the University of Tübingen, where he learned that there really was something even worse than a Catholic, and that was a Calvinist. Now, Kepler was appalled at what seemed to him to be an almost total perversion of Christianity. Surely God had not inspired Luther for the purpose of helping kill off Catholics. Surely a man could not be all bad simply because he saw the sacrament of the Last Supper in a different way. At Tübingen, Kepler fell into the hands of a fine teacher, Michael Mestlin, professor of mathematics. And Kepler, like Galileo, found in mathematics the perfection and the beauty of God. And in the heavens, he found the beauty that God had put into the universe and that offered an opportunity to understand the Creator to those who would use their minds to search for his perfection. As he wrote to Mestlin after leaving Tübingen, "I had hoped to serve God by being a theologian. Now I find that I can serve him by studying his works." But Kepler, the Lutheran, studied those works with the same biases that Galileo, the Catholic, had. God, the essence of perfection, must have thought in terms of beauty, specifically mathematical beauty, in creating this universe. Kepler's Harmonice Mundi, The Harmony of the Universe, is probably the single most notable book that has ever been written on astronomy. At first glance, one might think it's about music. It is. It's about the music of the spheres, the celestial music that is spun by the planets as they move around the sun. For to Kepler, beauty, mathematics, music, and the stars in the heavens all declare the glory of God, and all are different manifestations of that same glory. Now, for the past 45 minutes, I've been trying to suggest to you some evidence for a set of theses that I hold concerning the nature of science. To begin with, I don't think that science is very different from other creative activities. Second, nothing that we know would lead us to believe that any particular peoples have a racial superiority for science. And yet we find that science is an activity that has only been pursued at a very few times and in a very few places. The Greek culture was a highly scientific one. The Roman culture was absolutely sterile scientifically. Certain European countries at certain times have produced large quantities of scientists, whereas the United States, despite all of our hullabaloo about being scientific, has never contributed much to science. I would like to suggest that there seems to be an extraordinary coincidence between an interest in the arts and an interest in science, or perhaps in a broader sense, an interest in beauty and in science. And I would like further to suggest that this is a quite understandable correlation. For the notable scientists have been men who, generally speaking, were searching for beauty about nature. Science simply does not flourish in regions where painting and music is not admired. Scientists don't come from towns in which there are not legitimate theaters. And the converse is probably also true. And if there's a moral in all of this, I will leave it to you to decide what it is. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Oller. I think you have opened new vistas for most of us. I think you've presented a thesis which is not usually presented, and I think you've established it quite well. So thank you very much. The convocation is dismissed.